Good morning and welcome into the show. It is Daniel Ortman coming to you live from the Dream Imaginate Sports Studios. It is 8 a.m. on the East Coast, 6 a.m. out in the mountains, 5 a.m. out there out west. And for all of you who are battling the fires and the power outages, our thoughts and prayers and sympathies out to you. Hope you are surviving, doing well. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. It is Tuesday, October 29th. Welcome in to the show. Thanks for tuning in on this Tuesday morning. So yesterday, a couple big things happened, and we want to get to those right off the top of the show. First, the announcement. It was not as big of an announcement as LeBron leaving Cleveland to go to Miami. It was certainly not receiving near that level of hype either, but there was quite a bit of excitement yesterday as Sergino Dest chooses to play for the U.S. national team over the Netherlands. We talked about this on the show before he made the announcement, and one of the things that I looked at with this whole aspect of will he play for the U.S., will he play for the Dutch? He was born in the Netherlands. He was raised in the Netherlands. He didn't even start speaking English till a few years ago when he started playing with the U.S. national team. All of the signs, he plays for Ajax. He's getting minutes in the Champions League with Ajax. All of the signs were pointing to the Netherlands. When you look at things on paper, the one factor that was in the U.S.'s favor, and even then to me is kind of a bit of a spin, but is the fact that he was going to have an easier pathway to minutes with the U.S. national team. The competition was going to be much steeper with the Netherlands, and you know, if that was a big factor, we don't know the conversations he had with the Dutch Federation, etc. He had been playing in the U.S. setup for a few years. I don't know if that part of the emotion played into it, but he made it clear this was his decision, and he chose to play for the U.S. So, you know, welcome to the family. As I said, you know, if I was in his shoes and I felt like I had a legitimate shot, I would have chosen the Dutch for a variety of reasons. But I totally understand, you know, his decision as well. And, you know, the point I made from the beginning is, either way, we're happy to have him, and you know, and wish nothing but the best for him. Either decision he chose to make, and he chose to play for the U.S., and so we welcome him with open arms. It's fantastic, you know, for us to be able as a country to have a player playing in the Champions League and getting significant minutes. We have, you know, a few younger players that are playing in Europe at the moment that are, you know, getting some different opportunities, and we need more of that. We've talked about it on the show many times. The domestic league in Major League Soccer is not preparing our players adequately for international play. And so, you know, having an international player, a player that's grown up and living abroad, he is a dual national, and makes this decision to play for the U.S., you know, we are definitely happy to have him. And, you know, quite honestly, with the state of the program and you know, and the issues we've been having on the men's side for quite some time, we're lucky to have him, and we're very fortunate. And so I'm excited to see him make his full national team debut, and that will then lock him in with the U.S. for his national team career coming up with these competitive matches in just a couple weeks. Yesterday, also, the worst kept secret in the U.S. soccer realm of the last few days was finally officially announced yesterday, as Vlatko Andonovski was named the next manager of the U.S. women's national team. He was named as the NWSL coach of the season, and the 43-year-old becomes the ninth person to hold the U.S. women's coaching job and the first to do so as a product of a domestic women's professional league. Andonovski most recently managed Reign FC in the NWSL and won two titles with FC Kansas City. He is one of three people to hold a head coaching position since the league's inception in 2013. So, everything I've read about him from players who have played for him is positive. And he's gotten glowing reviews all around. So excited to see, you know, where the program goes and quite frankly grows under him. And if you are wondering, well, how is the program going to grow? They just won back-to-back World Cups and they've won Olympics. Like, how are they going to grow? There's a lot of room for improvement. We have players that are getting older and there's going to be a transition there. So we've got to have some growth in terms of younger generation. We also have a lot of areas to grow when it comes to tactics and playing as the sum of our parts as a collective, more than just a collection of individual players, which I felt like too often this U.S. women's national team resorted to individual play rather than team play. And so I hope and am looking forward to seeing some of that play out, and I'm hoping that you know, that we see some progress and growth in that area as well. Lastly, for something that I want to get into is the American Outlaw sent U.S. soccer a request for a meeting. They were upset with the performance against Canada. I haven't seen the letters where they were upset about all the other performances that we've been so bad at, but whatever. They sent a request and they said, we're not happy with where things are. We want to talk. And Greg Berhalter sent a message to the American Outlaws and said this: maybe it was anger after conceding the late goal or frustration regarding our performance. Either way, no matter what I was feeling after the final whistle in Toronto, I should have walked over to thank our traveling supporters. I screwed up and I apologize. You've been with this team through thick and thin and you deserve nothing less than our appreciation. I hope that you know you have it for every game. As a player who got to wear the U.S. jersey for the senior team starting back in 1994, I can vividly recall support from Sam's Army, who demonstrated to the world the passion and support that American fans brought to their national team. It meant so much to our team and to me personally. That connection has been passed on from generation to generation, and what the American Outlaws have built and grown has helped capture the spirit of what the sport can be in this country. There's no doubt in my mind that the support you bring to our team each and every match will continue to push us forward to new heights. And that is why we need you now more than ever. When we began this journey earlier this year, we established the mission of changing the way the world views American soccer. We asked this group of players, many of whom are promising talent, still developing and growing in their careers, to embrace this challenge and understanding that there would be highs and lows, that they would be placed in demanding situations, knowing that the results might not always go our way. Of course, we want to win, especially for our fans. We also know that as we work towards achieving our goals, progress won't always be reflected on the scoreboard at the end of 90 minutes. Nonetheless, we remain focused, committed, and determined to the process of building our team, playing bravely, and performing on the biggest stages. One thing we will not accept from our team is anything but the determination, effort, and absolute will to win. That is the essence of our country and our team. The next stop on this journey is Orlando, where we will face Canada again and where only a win will suffice. Believe me, we will not forget that night at BMO Field. It will serve as fuel for the fire as we seek both victory and some measure of redemption in the eyes of our supporters. The most important source of inspiration comes from you, our most loyal fans. This is a team, and against Canada on November 15th, you may be our most important player. Like you've done so many times before, if you have our back at Exploria Stadium, we promise you that each and every player who steps on the field will put forth an effort that will make you proud to say, "I believe," and mark another step in the process as we move to 2022. Sincerely, Greg. I'm going to get into some of those thoughts and expound on that a little bit later in the show. I found the letter to be a bit bizarre, and bizarre for a variety of reasons, and we're going to get into this, into that in just a little bit. But first, our sponsor this half hour is Ductic Brand. You can learn more about Ductic Brand at DUKTIGBrand.com. And use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order. They got some really cool apparel in the store, some really good resources. If you are a coach or a player, goalkeeper, check out some of their notebooks. It would definitely be a tool and a resource that you would want in your arsenal, including some of those which have waterproof paper. Again, that is DuckTickBrand.com, and use promo code DWSHOW to get 10% off of your next order at DuckTickBrand.com. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back into the show. Thanks for tuning in on this Tuesday, October the 9th. We are joined by Alex Fidrashevsky. Alex, hopefully I got your name right and didn't butcher it. Welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
I'm doing very well. A little chilly here in Pittsburgh, but otherwise we're doing well. Where are we going this morning?
So first off, how did you get connected to the game? Like, where did your love affair begin with the game of soccer?
Started when I was a kid. My grandfather is actually a member of the Polish Army team after World War II. Obviously, there wasn't really much of a national team in the late 40s, but he was part of the Army team that traveled around Europe and played, and then came to the United States and was dragging my dad to Randall's Island to watch all the showcase cups in the 50s and 60s. And then it kind of rolled into my dad going with him to Cosmos games in the 70s. And I started playing as a kid and just fell in love with it back then, and had an opportunity to get involved with it on a media standpoint. When I was running WGPA in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, we started doing FC Sonic games in 2014. We did those games on the radio, and then moved over to TV with the Bucksmont Torch on a local television outlet there. And then we started the soccer show on TV at the same time. And here I am today.
So obviously your grandfather was kind of the connection point for your family, brought the game with him.
Yes.
So did he come over after World War II or
after? Yeah. In the 50s. Yeah.
So growing up with, you know, obviously immigrant family moving over to the U.S. and then implanting this love of the game in your dad, and then into you, passed on to you. When you look at the American soccer scene at large, what has been your observations over the years? And we'll get into some specifics of, you know, current, like U.S. national team, youth national team stuff, but at large, as you've grown up with a family that's been in and around the game and loving the game, and, you know, ever since your grandfather made his way over and kind of began his family here in America, and you know, taking your dad to Cosmos games, and then obviously that love of the game passing on to you. What has been you and your family's kind of conversations about American soccer? Has it always been kind of this, what could be? Has it been disappointment? Like, what has been those conversations?
I don't know if it's necessarily disappointment. I think maybe more recently, I think there's been a little more thought of disappointment or discussion of, you know, almost like what Taylor Twellman rambled about 2 years ago after the Trinidad game. I think that was probably where it started. The real kind of, I don't know if you want to say it's a red flag, but in the discussions that, you know, I have with my dad, or that we've had on TV, or I've had with friends or guys that sit around us at the Red Bull games, or here at Pittsburgh Riverhounds games when I go, it seemed like that was a bit of a turning point. That prior to that, everybody was like, well, we're figuring it out. It's untapped potential, and we're figuring it out. And I think the general opinion of the soccer world over the last 2 years is what's going on. And where did America go off the tracks with its national team, at least as far as that's concerned? And then I think it's ripped open a Band-Aid for a lot of people as to everything else we do here, from youth development and church leagues all the way on up through the MLS academies to MLS to guys going abroad or not being sold or whatever it is that's gone on over the last couple of years. I think everybody is now, at least the way I look at it and the way the people I'm involved with and connected to, everybody's micromanaging everything that happens now. Because I think of Clint Dempsey hitting a crossbar. If that ball goes in the back of the net, I don't know if anybody has any of these conversations, but it didn't. And it might have actually been the best thing that happened, because if I think it's forcing everybody to take a look at the setup and say, well, like, you know, this isn't okay as far as us as a soccer nation of 300 and, you know, 300 and change million people.
So let's go back to October the 10th, 2017, Trinidad and Tobago, the U.S. national team, the men's national team, fall on their face, fail to qualify for the 2018 World Cup. In that moment, final whistle blows. What was going through your mind in that moment?
I think as an American soccer fan, it was probably the worst evening to that point of my U.S. soccer life. I think that it trumped not performing well in the 98 World Cup. I think that going into that tournament, I was only 11 years old, but I can recall beforehand my dad and some of the other fathers and kind of youth coaches around our group there at where I went to elementary school saying this team's really not that good. I mean, you know, we had to scrape by Canada to get here, and you know, we're going home. And I think that at least, you know, there's at least this idea then that, well, we at least made it. Now it was more of an expectation that, okay, so we have professional leagues, over 20 teams. We have all these, you know, academies. We have players that we've brought in from Europe. We have guys that are, you know, bouncing over there that are, you know, we should be significantly better than Trinidad's reserve team. And let's face it, that's what it was. They didn't really roll out the red carpet for the United States here and bring in their best. That game was really played by their B team. And that was probably even being kind that it was their B team. And I think that you saw a U.S. team that had no fight, that had no bite. It was pretty lackadaisical. It looked like they didn't want to be there. I mean, for what it's worth, they wanted to be carried across a little puddle so they could go train the day before the game. So I think there was that was really the red flag night where, you know, the day before those photos came out, and I remember seeing that and sitting there saying to myself, "Are you got to be kidding me? You know, all of a sudden you got a couple guys making $1 million in Major League Soccer on these big contracts coming towards the end of their career, and they're too good to train." So, I think you saw the problem start there, and then by the time this last loss happened, I didn't even look at it in shock or in horror. I looked at it before the game and said, well, with the roster that was called in, we got what we deserved. That Canada was better than us. They brought in better players than us. And they're, dare I say, a step ahead of where we're at right now, which is shocking considering where Canada was like 10 years ago.
No doubt. The aftermath of Trinidad and Tobago was kind of this wake up moment for the country. To me, it was that night that really allowed a lot of people to ask a lot of questions, and questions that may have been asked before, but either with less confidence, you know, when your national team is qualifying for the World Cup, you can complain and say, look, we're not doing enough, we're not getting better. But when the federation keeps coming back and say, well, you know, we keep qualifying for the World Cup, we're close, it's easy to kind of keep a perception going. And then when you have a failure like that, it's hard, you can't hide, there's nowhere to go to hide, everyone knows you didn't make it. Now people start asking questions. The difference that I found in that whole process is if this were any other country in the world, our top level, board members, president, vice president, etc., would have been resigning. You know, that, like, we didn't get the job done, we're stepping down. It's time for someone else to come in and manage this thing. And to me, when we didn't see that in the immediate aftermath, Arenas defiantly saying, I'm not going anywhere. And it wasn't until weeks later until he finally stepped down. And Sunil Gulati, the president at the time, was still debating on whether he was going to run or not. And he didn't decide not to run for reelection until he realized that his victory was not a sure thing. And so then at that point, he decided not to run, but he never actually stepped down. And that to me was a stark contrast to what we would see around the world. Yeah.
I think because the way we operate here is that the folks that run the national team and the federation, you know, most other countries around the world have it as a source of almost, almost a source of, I would say, personal pride. Whereas I think we've seen here that there's a lot more of a business dealing mindset to it with the way the U.S. Soccer Federation's been run here. And I think the other thing too is, as you said, you know, we could get away with always saying, well, we're almost there. We made the round of 16. We made the round of 16, you know, or you know, the run where, you know, they made it to, I believe it was the quarterfinals, you know, and there's always that next step. Well, like you had said, you know, when you don't qualify out of CONCACAF, which is, in my opinion, the easiest way to make it to the World Cup. I think that's one of those let's cut through the junk moments, you know, and unless there's a direct qualification spot that's coming out of Oceania, which basically hands New Zealand a bid to the World Cup, there's no easier way to get there than through CONCACAF, because the trip to Costa Rica and Azteca aside, if you can grab a draw down in Honduras and then just run the table at home, even with the way the World Cup is set up with the playoff bids and things, as long as you nick a draw at home against Mexico, or we even showed last time out, all they needed was a draw in Trinidad. That would have been enough. When you don't get that, in my opinion, and we went right at him on TV afterwards after that Trinidad game and said, when you don't get that draw, you can't hide anymore. You can't hide anymore. And I think for the last 2 years now, it's been a bit of a guns blazing moment. I think when Berhalter was named head coach, it raised the ire of fans even more. And then I think what we've seen in the last 12 months of Greg Berhalter has been more of the same. Maybe you want to say a step backwards, you know, and I've been pretty critical of the roster selection, as far as who's being brought in from where, and looking at this myself and just my what are we doing moment is saying, you know, did we learn from what happened the first go around with paying guys big bucks to stay domestic, when the first two guys that got those fat contracts domestically were Zuzi and Beisler and didn't go? And that was in the last cycle, and they didn't improve. They didn't get better. Who was going to take their spot in Kansas City? They spent their whole careers there. Great little cushy deal. Good for the pocketbook. Great for the pocketbook. These guys making $800,000-$900,000 a year, but did it benefit the national team to still be calling those guys in then? You know, some would say, well, who else did we have? Now I think there was a very good window that has been blown in the last 12 months that Sarakin actually tried to start after missing the World Cup, where it was the idea of almost to, you know, bleed the kids. Let's throw them in the deep end, you know, and we'll give them a life preserver to hold on to, because it's just friendlies. But let's try to see what, you know, let's see what these 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old kids have. Then Berhalter's named head coach, flip the switch, and here we are. You know, you have your Aaron Longs getting called in. Who, Aaron Long, great season last year. Did they move Aaron Long somewhere? No, Aaron Long got, he got the Beasley-Zuzzi deal. And quite honestly, you know, if you're Red Bull fan or not, U.S. fan or not, Aaron Long's 2019 has been a complete 180 from his 2018. So I think, you know, I, without getting too long-winded, I think we've just seen that you can't, they can't hide it anymore, and that, you know, you can't run away from the track record now over the last, you know, 2 years or so of failed results. And it shows to the senior level and all the way down. Now with the youth, you know, the youth setup, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about, I think there's a lot of potential coming through, but it's, you know, how are we going to utilize these guys in the next 5 years? Because the, what my co-host and I have talked about has always been 22, 26, and 30. Those, that's going to be our window with this group, with your Weyas and Pulisic and the rest of these guys. So how do we get ready for that is I think one of the biggest questions for at least me.
Looking at this current national team and Greg Berhalter, he released a letter, or a letter was released that he wrote to the American Outlaws after the American Outlaws, you know, released a public letter complaining to U.S. Soccer that, hey, we're not any good. Can we meet and talk about how we're not any good? And he responded with a letter. And in the letter, he talked about, you know, the need for the Outlaws to be there and support, and how much he's appreciated that support over the years as a former player and now the manager of the U.S. men's national team. In his response, he gave this typical American soccer, like, you know, I know you can't see progress, I know you're not seeing results, but give us time. I've got a plan, even though you can't see any of it and it doesn't actually work. We think it's going to work eventually, one day, maybe. Keep having our back. What was your take on his response? I thought it was a bit bizarre.
First, I think anywhere on earth, if a manager lost the game to a team like Canada, they probably would be out. Whether it was voluntarily or here's the door. I think that the beating Cuba aside, to take a loss like that is, especially in the manner they took it, I think for a lot of fans, I mean, let's face it, the national team was trending over a presidential debate. I mean, I know there's, and again, I spoke about this on one of our shows. I know there's 50 of them now, but for a brief period of time after that U.S. Canada game, I was sitting there on Twitter watching it, where U.S. MNT was trending higher than anything else. So clearly people's eyes were peeled to that game and the debacle that it was. And I read the letter, and I had heard the beginning of your show where you read the letter out there. It was the standard American press response where, I mean, gosh, there's almost there's like a running joke of it now that you see with some of these football coaches and things like that, where it's, you know, well, what did you think of the defensive line of the insert team? They're hungry. Thanks, coach. And the quarterback, he's smart. You know, there's no substance in this. All he said was, I should have gone and waved my hand at you so you guys could boo me. That solves what? And I don't know if a meeting with Greg Berhalter is necessarily the answer, because for what it's worth, Greg Berhalter probably wasn't the right guy for the job. Was that's not for me. You know, I'm not going to say he was a bad player. Greg Berhalter was actually, and this is, I think, where I'm surprised as to what's gone on with him. For a guy who played at such a high level over his career, you know, this isn't a guy who spent 15 years playing for the Dallas Burn and Colorado Rapids and maybe spent 1 year somewhere else. You know, when he was a player, this is a guy who played for the U.S. over 40 times. This is a guy who spent his entire career, except for the last, you know, 2 years of it in L.A., at really big time teams, you know, at 1860 at Palace. I know that was a short run, but he was at Energy Cottbus for a run, and he was in the Netherlands before that. You'd think for a guy who went and did it as an American at that next level, who went over to Europe and said, you know, saw exactly what you have to do if you want to get to where we're supposed to be getting to then turn around and bring in the players that are being brought in to basically give off the aura that it's okay if you want to, you know, if you're making a boatload of money in MLS to play here. I think is a big sticking point for me. And I know we didn't really delve into it. We could talk about that for 2 hours. You know, what's transpiring just on the league level and how that's a negative. I could sit with you for a day and go over it, and we could not even scrape the surface. But was a guy who was let go by Hammarby for being too defensive when they were in the second division in Sweden, and who had a half decent run and with a half stacked deck in Columbus, was that enough for the national team job? If you ask me, you know, they interviewed one guy over 1 year, and he was the only one.
Yeah,
so
I definitely see where you're going with that.
He could write this letter and say, okay, I'm, you know, we lost, I'm sorry. It's not like you lost on a fluke goal and I got caught up in the moment. It was a handball. I was too busy screaming at the referee after the game or screaming for a CONCACAF official because we got stuck. No, I sat back and watched the game. I don't think I've ever actively laughed at the national team before, but there's a first time for everything. I sat there watching that Canada game and laughed my head off the whole day. It sounds ridiculous that somebody who's kind of got some roots in the game like myself would sit there and laugh at the U.S. national team getting run off the field. But they didn't even look like they belonged in the same stadium as the Canadians that night. So nice letter, but where's the substance behind it? I know that for a while after the game, the Berhalter out thing was trending on Twitter as well. And it was, you know, where was the response from anyone at the Federation? Where was Berhalter to sit there and go, yep, this isn't good? Nope. Everybody just stood firm. Everybody patted each other on the back. It's okay. It's okay. It's okay. And, you know, and I said on our show on the corner kick, what's going to be the next step? If he beats Canada the second time, are we going to come back around and say, oh, everything's fine now? We won. We won 1-0. We won 2-1. We won the home game. See, we won the home game. That's what matters. We shouldn't be losing to Canada in the first place. Not with, you know, if everybody wants to say on MLS this thing, not with a 20-year head start.
Well, when we look at this Canada, this Canadian men's national team,
I was impressed.
I was impressed as well. I'm actually, if I'm Greg Berhalter and in U.S. soccer, I'm nervous about this rematch because Canada knows that they can beat you. They know that it wasn't a fluke, and that's what you brought that up, you know, just a second ago about the actual game. This was not a situation where, you know, it could have gone either way. Like, we hit the crossbar and this went out and we had this and we, like, there was no, like, woulda, coulda, shoulda moment. No moment where you could point back to and go, man, it was even. But if our guy, you know, just hits it 1 inch to the left, it's going to go in off the post rather than out off the post. That was not the performance we saw. What we saw was a well-earned, well-deserved Canadian victory that, quite frankly, could have been an even bigger victory because their performance was even more impressive to me than the 2-0 scoreline. That was a an American team on the field that had no solutions. They had no answers. And, you know, when I've coached teams in the past and even with my own two kids, I talked to them about a process of confidence, that before you can get confident, you have to be comfortable. And once you get comfortable, then you can get confident. And once you get confident, then you can get that really, really like nasty, healthy cockiness that allows the best to be the best in the world. They've got that extra, you know, 10% or whatever of just self-confidence that just oozes out of them, that basically allows them to be audacious in whatever sport they're playing. And when I look at this U.S. men's national team, I look at a team that is lost, that has no answers. They have no idea what to do. And when you don't have any idea what to do, means you're not comfortable, which means there's no way we're going to go out and play confident. That's on the manager. That's your job, is to teach the players how you want them to play. And just because you're saying something, if they're not getting it, then you're not doing it right. It's not the player's fault that they don't understand you. It's your fault that you have not been able to get on the same page with your players. I mean, that is leadership 101. And so to deflect and immediately after the game kind of point the finger at the player saying they didn't give enough, that they didn't want it bad enough, I think is an absolute cop out. And, you know, when I look ahead to this rematch, I don't know that these American players, top to bottom, are going to be prepared, much less with the mentality required to really compete. If Canada comes in, and this is going to be the, you know, this classic case of, you know, we won at home. Do they have the mental fortitude to do it on the road? If Canada comes in and puts out the same performance that they did up in Toronto, we are in trouble. And it's not because of emotion. It's because they're playing, at least that night, they were playing better soccer. You could tell they had an idea of how they wanted to play. And if they come out with that same mentality and they couple that with, look, we don't care that we are on the road, we want to make another statement, like, let's go get this and come out and really play confidently, I think we're going to have some issues. I think too many people are kind of saying, well, we're going to play Canada here in the U.S. Like, we're going to get our revenge. I'm not confident in that. What's your take on this?
Listen, this isn't you're not taking a trip to San Pedro Sula here. What's there for the Canadians to fear? You're going to go up against, assuming they're going to bring in a similar team, you're going to go up against 18 or 19 Major League Soccer players in Orlando. If I was a Canadian team, I wouldn't be sitting there, if I'm Herdman, saying, okay, well, we won at home, we're going away, we need to sit back and we need to just try to absorb, let's see if we could get 0-0. Coming to the play in Orlando, I would, if I'm them, I would just try to bang the doors down again. There's nothing, you're not going up, you know, the 2 miles to Azteca. You're not going to, again, Honduras, which is going to be, they're going to make you play the game at, you know, as Canada has seen themselves in World Cup qualifying. They're not going to make you play the game at 2 p.m, give the entire country the day off, give away free tickets, and it's going to be 150 degrees with 200% humidity. You're going to play on a comfortable fall evening in Orlando. What if I'm the Canadians, just from that perspective alone, you know, you got them at home. What do you have to fear to not go after them in Florida next, you know, in a couple of weeks? So it's 2 weeks away. And when I watched that game, for me, I think you're right about Berhalter, where you're trying to, it's the system. We need to build play out of the back. Well, you don't have the players to do it. So when you don't have the players to do it, you either need to change what you're doing or get out of the way. And if they're going to continue to try to do that without having anyone in the back capable of making the next pass, it's going to be a problem. And I think we saw that in in the Gold Cup final against Mexico, where they looked disjointed. We definitely saw it in the friendly against Mexico. The only guy who can hit balls forward out of the back is Tim Ream. If they take him out of the equation early on, if you can get pressure on him and he has to distribute it across the back line to somebody else, you can bang 3, 4, 5 in on the United States. And I think that you're right. I think the coaching strategy is a big issue. I think there's a little bit of both, where, you know, it's column A and column B. I don't think Berhalter's wrong to say that there's not a lot of bite in this team. You're still bringing in Michael Bradley, who walked to take a corner kick in stoppage time with the World Cup on the line. You know, you're still bringing in guys who are making triple their value overseas, and great that the league wants to pay these guys to stay home. But if you're the national team coach, you have to say, you signed that 5-year deal with the Seattle Sounders at $1 million a year. Have fun. It won't be in my setup. We don't have a coach that's doing that right now. And I think so you have, I don't think he's wrong, but he's not innocent. I think that that you have multiple guilty parties here. And from a player's perspective, I don't blame an Aaron Long for signing the deal with Red Bull for whatever it was, $750,000-$800,000, and sticking around. You know, he was making $60,000-$70,000. They multiplied his number by 10. So, good for him. If I'm a player, I guess you strongly consider your bank account, because you're only going to play for a few years. But it's not providing the level of competition and training that they need. You're bringing in, 18 guys who, there's never a threat to their spot, ever. There's nobody on their team that, because of how much they're paid or where they're at, they're safe. Jordan Morris stayed home for a puppy dog. And he's a decent player, but the potential that he didn't tap into, or is now tapping almost, if you want to say too late, he's 25. You can get one cycle out of the guy. You got through Qatar. He'll be 29. You're really going to keep him around for 26 and bring him in at 33 years old when you have Luca Della Torre and Novakovic and all these other young players? You know, I think that goes for a bunch of these guys. Yassi Zardes, he'll be 30. He'll be 31, 32 when the 22 World Cup rolls around. I think that there's multiple parties that are guilty here. I think MLS is part of the problem, a big part of the problem, overpaying guys, not moving guys on, bringing in tons and tons. And I've talked about this on our show, tons and tons of foreign players. And, I think it's great that they want to try to market themselves to be one of the best leagues in the world. But anybody who watches multiple foreign leagues will tell you, it's probably, if you look at the UEFA coefficient, MLS would be somewhere in the probably the 20s. As far as it's, how their teams would stack up on a continental level. If fans of the English game that I've spoken to former players in England that I see at some of these games in Pittsburgh. I've spoken to guys who've been involved in the game for 50 years over there who say it's like League One. So I think we have to look at that and say, well, there's a part of the problem. We're bringing in a League One team. You're bringing in the equivalent of a Bristol Rovers kind of player. Well, you're going to get Bristol Rovers kind of results at the next level. And I think what's even scarier for me beyond that, when just to come back to Tanner real quick, the Canadian MLS players outperformed ours in that game. Their MLS players outplayed our MLS players. And our guys, again, our guys are the big money guys. They're the ones making 500, 700, a million, whatever dollars. And their Major League Soccer players, they actually, in my opinion, I really do think outplayed ours. I think Samuel Piette was probably the best midfielder on the field that night for either team. That's probably truly a midfielder, because Alphonso Davies, much more of a dynamic attacking player, and these other guys they have going forward. I look at who they have going forward. I think Canada is much better off in the attacking positions, just in their pool than we are. And not just at the younger ages where they've got three guys who I think are going to be kind of their rock for the future. You have, you know, David at Ghent, Davies is at Bayern and seeing time at Bayern, and David is seeing time at Ghent. Liam Miller, he's a Kilmarnock in Scotland. And then even, you know, into the prime ages, you have still Junior Hoilett around, and Lucas Cavallini's down in Mexico. Kyle Larin, he's still lurking around their national team setup. And, you know, and Balou, you see, ended up back at Montreal this year. They didn't really integrate him too much, but I mean, this is a guy who's contracted to Barcelona right now. The U.S. has this type of youth talent, but Canada was willing to roll the dice and bring him in. And it paid dividends against us, where I think for the last 2 years we've been calling for, well, give these kids a shot, give the U23 crop a shot, the U20 crop, anybody under that age, let's give them a shot. Canada gave a lot of those guys a shot against us, and they earned it. So I think that it's a multifaceted problem to kind of just wrap that part up for me. I think you have to blame Berhalter for being, this is what we're doing and this is what we're doing, whether it works or not, I don't care, this is what we're doing. You have U.S. soccer standing by idly or in support of, who knows what's going on there. I'm not ear to the rail to their office, but clearly they're not doing anything to change, so they're idle in this. And then you look at the interests of Major League Soccer and where they're at. I think it kind of all ties together to create the problem that we're in right now. And we didn't even mention the idea of any youth development, whether it's through an MLS academy or anywhere else.
So last few questions here, kind of rapid fire.
Go for it.
So looking, you know, let's go out to the macro, and then we're going to kind of hit a couple, you know, specific topics, questions. And I just want to get a quick take from you on each of these. Looking at the macro, U.S. men's national team, should we be going younger, focusing on kind of an Olympic aged next cycle, Christian Pulisic, Weston McKennie and below?
100%.
Okay. Now,
we don't even need to finish the question. In my opinion, 100%. If you're over 24 and you're in Major League Soccer and I'm the national team coach, I don't need you. Next question.
All right. So next question, looking at our youth national team, U17 World Cup, got off to a struggle, did not look good. What do you see coming up in that next generation at that kind of U17-ish level? Are there players that were not called in, or do you see this as kind of, you know, an eye-opening assessment that we don't have the talent at the youth levels that we thought we did?
It's hard to tell with kids. I think Gio Reyna is going to turn out just fine. I think Busio is going to turn out just fine. I think Joe Scally is going to be a really good player. It's really tough, I think, to judge guys at that level. I think there's usually some eye to the future that, okay, there's a group here for any country, and say, okay, yeah, some of these kids are definitely going to pan out. I count maybe three or four that I think are, you know, kind of for sure things out of our group. And again, you're speculating on a high school kid right now. I'm part of a Polish soccer kind of group amongst media guys there that cover the league in Poland and the national team. And we were actually going on about this because right before the World Cup started, this U17s talking about, you know, busts over the years. And there were some names that we brought up, in the Polish circle, that were guys who everybody was like, oh, you know, this is going to be great. He, you know, he was born in Germany. There's one player, Sebastian Rostock, specifically, who I brought up. He went and spent 9 years in the Bayern youth system. He was German. He was German-born, Polish parents who were living there. Played for the Polish U19s, played for the Polish U20s. Didn't pan out as a pro. He's playing. He's in Zwei Bundesliga right now with Wiesbaden, but you know, they just got promoted to the Bundesliga. They're in the bottom of it. And as far as that level, we're like, okay, so you didn't, you know, this didn't work. I think it's tough to really judge how a kid's going to do with the 17s versus where he's at when he's 20. You might have kids who are 17 that are topped off. You know, they matured early. And they're in that, you know, it's almost like you see sometimes you get a high school basketball player or a high school football player, the man among boys thing, where, you know, the guy's a senior in high school and he got the full beard thing basically already. And then, you know, he's a junior in college and he's the 10th guy on the bench. So I think it's hard to tell. I don't want to say that we're in trouble, but, you know, I got to watch some of that game. I didn't watch it in its entirety, but, yeah, I think there's some red flags there. They got an early goal, but they couldn't sustain it over the, you know, over the full course. So we'll see what happens in the next two games. I try not to worry too much about a youth, you know, the U17s. I think when you start to get to that more Olympic age, like the, you know, say your 20s and 23s. Now you're dealing with guys who are more physically matured, who should be getting to that next step. And I think if there's one thing I will take away from this 17s group, I don't know how many of these guys are going to be really good enough to crack into major European teams. I think there might be some kids who could get into the second, the kind of your second tier there, but I don't know how many of them are going to be good enough to hit the next level. I think the 20s are really the crop for us right now.
Last question. If you were king of U.S. soccer for a day, American soccer for a day, you had absolute power to do anything with your one day in charge, what would you do?
Oh boy. Half the people that listen to you are going to want me to say that I'm going to strip the MLS of Division One and institute promotion and relegation, because that's the magic button that's going to fix every problem that American soccer has ever had. And that's not the answer. And that's definitely not what I would do. I think if I had 24 hours in charge of U.S. soccer, I would probably, I don't think that's enough unless you have the executive order stroke of the president of the United States, where, you know, you could just sign it and say, this is it, I'm doing it. And, you know, I don't know if there's a one day answer, you know, cause I think it's just so complicated for me. You know, some would probably say fire Greg Berhalter. Maybe fire Greg Berhalter. Bring in a coach that's not an establishment guy, who isn't it. Maybe, I guess that would be it. I'd probably clean house and bring in non-establishment people. But with some and MLS so intertwined in USSF, great question. I don't have an answer for you, because I just don't think we can fix this in one day. I think this starts from age 7 and goes all the way up to the national team, Major League Soccer. Guys not going to Europe, because that's, at least in my opinion, you want to push on, that's where you need to be. That's where you got to go. You know, some people say, well, you know, MLS versus Belgium. Yeah, hey, go to Belgium. There's better players there. It's not even a question for me. I think if I had one thing, that would probably be my mandate. One day, maybe it's either clean house or put out some type of, you know, mandate that's like, listen, you want to get good, this is where you need to go.
Well, I think when you look at what you can do with your one day in charge, leadership change is something that could be like an executive order that continues beyond that day, because new personnel, new ideas, new leadership is actually what we need more than anything else. And out of that leadership, we can get corrected systems and structures going forward. So I actually think you're on to something there with your leadership answer.
Let's go with leadership then.
How can people connect with you and learn more about your work and follow you on social media?
Best way to do that is to check me out on Twitter at FID Sports. FYD Sports is where you can find me, and then our show We've been a little admittedly lax with our account lately, but it's at Corner Kick USA. You can catch us there too. And then I always link everything we do on my own account. Now it's not just a soccer account. I also do other sports too, but it's probably 90% soccer. So,
well, thanks for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back on again soon to get into more of this, and maybe next time we'll get into some youth development, because that's a whole show unto itself, I think.
Oh my gosh, we dedicated show after show to it ourselves, just talking about JJ, my co-host, and I, about our own experiences growing up in New Jersey and what we've done there. So yeah, I think that I think the topics are limitless, but thank you again for having me on, Daniel. And anytime you want me back, you just give me a holler and I'll be there.
Sounds good. Thanks for joining the show. We really appreciate it. We do look forward to having you back on. So thanks for coming on.
Hey, thank you so much. You take care.
All right. Bye-bye. That is Alec Fidrishevsky, and I really appreciate him coming on to spend some time with us. Our sponsor this half hour is Charity Water. You can learn more about Charity Water at charitywater.org. We'll be right back after this.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. Bad water and a lack of toilets kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Or you could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens.
I'd like to thank Alex Fidrishevsky for joining us today. Looking back to that Greg Berhalter letter, the big thing when I look at all of that is, instead of talking about what you want to do or the change you want to see to the public, go do it. Get it done. Show tangible evidence and proof. I see this over and over in organizations, not just soccer clubs or soccer coaches, but I want to do this, or I want to be this, or we want to be this as a company or as an organization. Rather than go out and set all these expectations, go deliver. Do it first, talk about it later. And that means get the work done, then brag about it afterwards. I would much rather see that with our U.S. men's national team than these continued struggles while we see bloviations about how things are going to get better and change. Right now, we don't see any proof of that. So thanks for watching the show. You can watch always at facebook.com/WRKMN or at danielworkman.com. You can also check me out on Twitter or Instagram @DanielWorkman. Thanks for watching. We'll see you again tomorrow.